I call you, ladies and gentlemen. You know what you are. For the first time on any screen, there lies stories of women who love women and men that love men. See their side. Hear them out. Don't have a closed mind. Be open before making your decision. See gay liberation. Every family with relatives is involved. Out of the closet and into the streets.
You are listening to Queer Review on CHRW 94.9. Queer Review is in association with the Pride Library, located on the main floor of the Weldon Library at the University of Western Ontario. Queer Review broadcasts every other Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. To listen online, please visit queerreviewradio.blogspot.com. Today I'm welcoming Terrence Kissack, the former executive director of the San Francisco Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Historical Society out of Berkeley, California. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, John.
I wanted to start off with why you wrote the book you did, which will be the topic of today, which is Free Comrades, Anarchism and Homosexuality in the United States between 1895 and 1917. What inspired you to write this book?
Sure. Well, it was my doctoral dissertation. And before coming to this particular topic, which is kind of, you know, late 19th, early 20th century anarchism, I had done a paper on the late 60s, early 70s, gay liberation, lesbian feminism, a very exciting kind of time in queer politics. And I was especially interested in the intersection of left or socialist politics and sexual politics, because it's such a kind of, a fertile area, but that's perhaps too loaded a metaphor. It's a very productive area for people to rethink basic social structures and norms. So I was looking at the late 60s, early 70s, and like lots of people who are interested in history, I started asking myself, well, what came before? What came before? And so I began to read around a little bit and happened upon the anarchists. Not so much happened, because really they were the only ones during this period who were making noise around this issue. So it was a natural that I would find them eventually. So it was more kind of an intellectual curiosity, and also they're just a fascinating, fascinating group of people.
And for people who don't know, what is anarchism? And if it makes it easier, how did these people see anarchism at the time?
Sure. Well, anarchism is a bit of a contested term. There are kind of different streams within anarchist politics. All of them essentially reject kind of a state-centered political organization. They look to self-organized communities. Some, the communist anarchists, held property in communally, hence the name communist anarchism. There was also individualist anarchists who were more what you might think of as they wanted to have kind of more an independent organization of individuals. Each of them arrive at a goal, which is a free society, and by free they meant a society without hierarchical relationships. They had different critiques of capitalism and different ideas of how to organize economic relations, but they rejected the kind of growth of industrial capitalism that you had at the late 19th century, the rise of great fortunes and the centralization of power, both in private hands and in the hands of the state. Anarchism is essentially a reaction against the dual developments of a central, powerful state married to enormous private wealth.
There were a few organizations before them, one being the Scientific Humanitarian Committee. What was the difference between that group and the anarchists at that time?
Sure. So the anarchists in the United States, and let me speak briefly about the anarchists in the United States, they had a sexual politics because, as I just said, they rejected hierarchical relationships and they rejected state power and authority. And there was a strong critique of marriage within that. Remember, marriage in the late 19th century and I'm talking about heterosexual marriage, the man would essentially gain ownership of his wife in many ways, legally speaking. There was a doctrine called femme couverte, which means covered woman. So her property and essentially her rights as a citizen were subsumed under that of her husband. And of course, the anarchists rejected this. They said that each individual should have the right to exercise their own free will and their own desires. So they had a sexual politics centered largely around a critique of marriage. The Scientific Humanitarian Committee was a group in Germany that developed more out of a kind of scientific, an intersection between the scientific community and active members of what we might call now the GLBT community. They were not coming necessarily out of the anarchist movement. There was interaction between the two because in the late 19th century, one of the best known American anarchists was a woman named Emma Goldman. She was a fierce feminist, and she was fascinated with the topic of sexuality, particularly as it related to individual liberty. So she was in contact with many of these other groups, and their thinking informed her politics. But she read the works of the sexologists of the late 19th century, people like Kraft Ebbing and Magnus Hirschfeld and Edward Carpenter. Through her own lens, she saw them as a reimagining of what it could be to have a personal relationship. She rejected the kind of use of science as a regulatory mechanism, you know, who's sick and who's sane. She wanted rather to see great variety in life and to see that that's a good in and of itself and that people should be allowed to pursue their interests and desires. I hope that, I know there was a lot in that answer, but that's the relationship kind of between the two.
What's your theory about, I guess you answered it with the hierarchy issue, but why was just this section, this small section of American society willing to tackle this issue in, through what, lectures and pamphlets and workshops and militant actions?
What I kind of lay out in the book is how the anarchists constructed a politics of sexuality, an explicit politics in the way that we understand it. Absolutely right. They gave public lectures. They wrote about the subject of same-sex desire in their magazines. They really made it an issue of political consideration. There were certainly people who, on a day-to-day basis, resisted and tried to carve out a life for themselves, but they were the first, the anarchists were the first to articulate a political argument around queer rights. And the reason why they came to it, it's probably because they were primed. They did already have a sexual politics. They understood that sexuality, that intimate relations, was not outside the scope of power relations. So their critique of marriage, in which they said state-sanctioned, church-sanctioned institution is oppressive, gave them the tools, the kind of way of looking at the world that permitted them when something like the Oscar Wilde trial happened. So in 1895, there's this really international, transatlantic sex scandal in which Oscar Wilde, this leading kind of cultural figure of the time, is pilloried for having relations with other men. And they saw the anarchists were able to talk about this in a political way. They weren't just talking about it as a kind of, you know, a scandalous story or a morality tale. They had a political story to tell. They were able to say, here you see the state taking hold of this man for his personal relations with others and imprisoning him. And so they understood all that drama, if you will, through a political lens. Once that had happened and this subject emerged, in a new way, they then were able to see it played out in more areas just than the Oscar Wilde trial.
You do have a chapter on Oscar Wilde, the trial, and all the politics behind that. Very interesting. Or you have another one as well, a couple of them. One is Alexander Berkman's text. Now, you credit this as being one of the first texts on homosexuality in the United States. Can you go into a bit of the importance of it and what exactly happened in that book that he wrote?
Sure. So that chapter, I really look at prisons. And anarchists, of course, were familiar with prisons. Many of them were imprisoned, including Alexander Berkman, for their political activity. Now, Berkman, to make a long story short, tried to assassinate one of the leading industrialists of the period, a man named Frick, who had crushed a strike of steelworkers. It was a very dramatic, the Homestead Strike, a very well-known strike at the turn of the century. And Berkman, thinking that he would take action directly against Frick, tried to kill Frick, and he was unable. He was unsuccessful, but Berkman was put in jail. When he, and this was in the early 1890s, if I remember my dates correctly, when he emerged from prison in the early 20th century, around 1910, 1909, he wrote his memoirs, Prison Memoirs of an Anarchist. And this is a really fascinating book. Whether or not you're interested in anarchism or sexuality, it's a really brilliant testimony of a person who kind of makes it through a very harsh experience. But he wrote about his experience in prison, and that included homosexuality, which, of course, is part of prison life. But interestingly enough, he talked about it, again, in this political way. He understood it both, he condemned those manifestations of same-sex sexuality in prison that were oppressive, prison rape and domination. He condemned that. But he also recognized that in prison, there were intense, even physical relationships between men that were part of the way that people resisted and survived prison. And he has a pretty in-depth discussion of it. So what I say is that this book is really the first major book that discusses the social and cultural place of homosexuality, of same-sex desire, in a way that's kind of very open to it and nuanced. You know, he condemns that which we know of as kind of, you know, prison rape, et cetera. He condemns it. But on the other hand, he talks, he speaks quite at length of very positive relationships that he both experienced and discussed with other prisoners. It's unclear whether he ever had physical intimacy with other prisoners, but it's quite clear that he had intense emotional bonds. And I think his personal experience and his anarchist politics gave him a perspective that was unique at the time. And it's a really brilliant book. I think it's been re-released a number of times. I think you can find it at used bookstores and whatnot. It's a worthwhile book to look at.
I noticed that you mentioned also in the book a essay called Free Comrade. I'm assuming this relates to the title in some way. What was the Free Comrade essay?
Sure. So Free Comrades is both the title of the book, Free Comrades. It's also the title of a publication that an anarchist named John William Lloyd, among others, put out. And John William Lloyd, in this publication, on a number of different occasions, writes about Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman, the poet, wrote rapturously about the love of comrades. And it's really interesting to kind of look at the way that people talked about Walt Whitman's poetry. So for many people, it was simply very respectable, deep love between friends. Other people, like Edward Carpenter in England, and John William Lloyd in the United States, and by the way, these two were in conversation with each other. Lloyd and Carpenter knew each other and wrote to each other frequently. They saw in Whitman a very kind of powerful text validating same-sex desire. So in his publication, he talks, in this Free Comrade publication, he talks about Whitman's work. And I also found like the whole phrase, Free Comrades, to be so evocative of what the anarchists were aspiring to. Freedom, both on an individual basis in terms of personal relations, and freedom in terms of freedom from state rule, freely organized societies. That was their goal. So it's kind of powerful in that way, and it also is a great way to open a whole discussion of Whitman, who was one of the key figures that they explored and used as a reference point when talking about same-sex desire. Goldman, for example, notes later in her life, she talks about Whitman's homosexuality, and so it's just one of the ways that the conversation came up.
It's interesting. There is a connection to London here of Walt Whitman. He did come when he was alive here, and he befriended a man called Buck, his last name was, and he helped really revolutionize the practices in what was then called the London Insane Asylum.
Wow.
Yeah, and they were quite close friends, and there is a film about it.
Really?
Yeah, it's an interesting story, and so if anyone in London can drop by the London Room at the Central Library, and there's some information there about it. And the movie's called Beautiful Dreamers. You are listening to Queer Review on CHRW 94.9. And now we will continue with our interview with Terence Kissack, the author of Free Comrades, Anarchism and Homosexuality in the United States between 1895 and 1917.
I can speak a little to the way in which anarchist politics impacted people outside the movement.
Yeah, what was the influence? Because I noticed that Goldman and others were very unsatisfied with some of the reaction to their politics, namely the sexual liberalism of the 1920s. They seemed to have a distaste of this time. What were they dissatisfied about?
That's kind of a complicated thing to talk about. By the 1920s, the anarchists themselves, many of them, American anarchists like Goldman and Berkman, had been exiled. They were expelled from the United States for their political activity during the First World War. They had opposed America's entry into the First World War. And they found themselves also in the wake of the Russian Revolution. The left was dominated by Marxist-Leninists, the Communist Party, and nascent Communist parties across the Western world. And the anarchists were a bit sidetracked, and the communists were quite critical of the anarchists. So they felt really beleaguered. At the same time, you have in the 20s, in the United States and in Europe, you know, people talk about the roaring 20s, bobbed hair and, you know, jazz. And it seemingly was a very liberal moment. But from the perspective of the anarchists, who had a kind of more deep political critique of sexual relations and of sexual politics and of gender politics, it was kind of a false liberation. So the fundamental structures of gender hierarchy hadn't changed. You had an expansion of commercially available spaces in which sexuality could manifest itself, and people could explore that part of their life, and that's a good thing. But I think from the so the anarchist Goldman was feeling by that time a little disillusioned in the broadest sense. She had been expelled from the United States. Her political views were under siege from her left, if you want to call the Communist Party the left, of her, and the right, which had always, of course, been critical of anarchism. And at the same time, the liberty of sexual expression that she sees around her, she finds to be a little shallow. So, you know, maybe they were feeling a little disillusioned. But I think that also speaks to, in the United States at least, after World War I, and because of the war and the politics around the war, the United States moved quite vigorously to crush dissent during that period. If you were opposed to America's entry in the First World War, you found yourself on the sharp end of a stick, sometimes quite literally. But anarchist publications were closed down, and networks were broken up, and so the 20s were rough. But still, you see kind of continuing echoes of their work. You find poets like Elsa Gidlow, who was the first woman in the United States to publish explicitly self-identified lesbian work, who was an admirer of the anarchists. I don't think she herself had a really profound immersion in the politics, but she was inspired by them. So, you know, their work had impact, but by the 20s, the anarchists themselves, the people who were so active at the turn of the century, were scattered and in some ways disillusioned, although many of them continued to, you know, in their efforts.
Yeah, from my impression, that time period is probably, from what I've seen, the most repressed, oppressive and repressive times ever, from in terms of the state upon the society. I know with the, there was the Palmer raids,
yeah,
there was this, the anti immigration act or something like that.
Yeah.
And one of the largest mass trial in U.S. history, which was the rounding up of over 164 IWW leaders, and they were all tried at once and convicted, and a lot of them deported. And
yeah,
it just seemed like the fist came down so hard at that time, and I don't know what they were so threatened by, but yeah, it seems like that was a really scary time.
Absolutely. It was the high watermark for what they called the second wave of Ku Klux Klan activism in the United States, the first having come in the wake of the Civil War. But in the 20s, that's when you find, you know, giant marches through major American cities organized by the Ku Klux Klan, and they had significant political power. So it's a very weird period. This, on the one hand, seemingly liberal, you know, jazz age, and on the other hand, as you just pointed out, incredible political repression. And so maybe that's, you know, that atmosphere, the anarchists, I guess, were just really disillusioned. You know, think of the people who had invested, Goldman and Berkman invested so much of their life into really trying to construct a liberatory world, and to have that as an outcome. So, yeah, it's a little frustrating for them, I think, at that point in their lives.
What do you think people should take away from this story? You know, gay rights is on the rise globally, and there's the debates in the United States and the tenuous laws that are being passed and put forward and removed and amended and on gay marriage and everything like that. What can we take from these old lessons of these radicals who just were uncompromising and militant and you know, demanded freedom without any footnotes or anything like that?
Right. Well, I think one thing to look at is they had a very expansive view of what it meant to be free. So, you know, when we have, I'll speak in the United States, you know, we have well-organized gay rights organizations, and I know you have to have a focus for your politics, but oftentimes, you know, if a person is free to be gay, for lack of a better term, but, you know, doesn't have health care, but, you know, lives in poverty, or is struggling with other forms of exclusion, then, you know, what is gained? So I think we need to really always keep in mind a very expansive political perspective, and the anarchists certainly had that. It can be confusing and overwhelming at times to think about everything simultaneously, but to not be overly focused on an identity politics, maybe, you know, to kind of have a broad perspective on what it is to be a free and equal society. Specifically around the issue of marriage, it's very interesting because, of course, the anarchist sexual politics were grounded in a critique of marriage. That's really where it came from in the late 19th century. Now, marriage then and marriage now are very different things. So I don't think we can say that all the anarchists would have been completely opposed to, you know, the push for gay marriage. On the other hand, gay marriage in and of itself, or same-sex marriage, is, you know, there is a whole kind of critique around it that could say you're just kind of co-opting, you're buying into a model of relationships that is kind of inherently hierarchical, that is kind of patriarchal, that has these kind of historical vestiges of, you know, inequality, family politics are complicated, and we have to kind of look at them and critically before we kind of embrace the model. So I would say that anarchist thinking around sexuality and around liberation broadly are really relevant, whether you're an anarchist or not. You know, it's a really fascinating way to think about social relations, economic relations, and you know, I think it always is helpful if you expose yourself to different ideas and different ways of thinking of the world. So the anarchists did that. You know, that was their life's effort, was to try to make something new. And whether or not you end up agreeing with them, it's a really bracing kind of way to challenge yourself and to think about what is freedom really, and how do I lead a good life. So
yeah, and I know from Emma Goldman's perspective that she almost took any liberal type of reform as she rejected. And one of the examples that she also I remember from reading about her was women's right to vote. She had no sympathies with this, really. She thought that, you know, people's power comes in a lot more profound way and through the workplace and direct democracy and things like that. She thought nothing of the suffrage movement, really. And I know that often, I think one critique of the marriage thing, and again, I have no personal qualms with it, but they were saying, some of the anarchists were stating that they don't need to be recognized by the state for anything, because they're basically anti-statist. So, you know, that was one of their perspectives.
To find out more about Terence Kissack's work, please visit lgbthistory.org.
Oh, yes, I've got an old friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. You keep me in jail and you lock me in prison. Your hospital's jammed and your crazy house full. What made your cop kill my trade union worker? You'll have to talk plain, 'cause I've sure got to know. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go.